Then this discussion was increasing all the time. And I think it's kind of critical in order to understanding what does racism mean also in the Finnish context. So the discussions have started elsewhere, but now more and more people in Finland, racialized people, but also white people have started to talk about what is kind of this notion of whiteness and what does it mean in general. So in this lecture, I'm talking about like overall things like more like in terms of discussion that is also taking place in the English-speaking world, because I think that's where most of the literature comes from at the moment. But I'm aware of that there are also a lot of things that are happening in the Finnish context, more kind of discussions going on about that, and to understand like how whiteness has been operating in Finland in different times. And just to like mention like how whiteness and racism have been kind of part of the Finnish context in very like kind of everyday ways. There is a story that I was thinking from my own family recently when I was preparing this lecture. And this story happened before the Second World War. That is actually when one of my relatives was born. And in the family on one side, they had people who had very dark hair, but white skins. And then when this baby was born before the Second World War, her auntie said that you have to cover the head of the baby before it will be baptized. Usually the babies were baptized so that the water was put on the head without being it covered, because the baby's hair was so dark hair that it couldn't go that way. And obviously we can see that there was something related to black hair in this situation. Also in the Finnish context, everyone involved in this was kind of Finnish people. But that's something like that you cannot have black hair, that's somehow against the sort of norms there and how it should go and et cetera. So when I was preparing this lecture, I was thinking about these incidents that happen, that how kind of in a very everyday ways, whiteness and racism has been there, and also kind of some kind of connotations that are there that don't always mean that how we make a difference between people of white or people of color or black people, but also like how within Finnishness as overall generalizations having white, it's something that there have been made differences between people. And then of course we also know that what comes to Roma people, for example, and Samis, we know about the colonization of Samis. And then if you think about Roma people before having migrants coming more from African countries, Roma people were the colored ones. And they were played against like what is whiteness and what is not whiteness. So there is always this kind of negotiation historically going on, like what these things mean. So basically, this is I'm trying here to open up this dynamic and giving you kind of tools and backgrounds for what is whiteness about, how it's related to different historical processes, and then kind of that this could be something you can use and think about like how it works in different contexts. Let's say when we go to Asian context and different Asian countries, it might be very different. Finland is different from the US. Latin American countries are different from the US or Finland as well, et cetera. Maybe Italy is different from Finland, et cetera. So it means that we always need to, of course, think about how these things play in our own contexts, because there are similarities, but then there are also a lot of differences as well. So basically, I'm trying to bring here these ideas together based on what I've been doing before myself, my research, but then also the broad range of literature. And here are a couple of books I have collected together for you to see like what are related, let's say, discussions about whiteness and racism in the US, Latin America, and then there are some from French-speaking contexts and Nordic contexts, etc. And these are a couple of examples that might be useful for you as well. So first, like, why is it important to discuss about whiteness? Why it's so central for us there? So one of the reasons I already mentioned is that we need to kind of look the other side of racism and kind of need to turn the telescope to ourselves in case we are considered as white or when whiteness is seen as the norm in the society. So we can think about that whiteness and racialization are omnipresent in the everyday discourse in society and in social and institutional actions. We also have racially coded language, like Angelina Castaño talks about. So we use the terms like second language learners, language minority students, multicultural students, diverse students, migrant students, migrant background students, etc. And what we mean actually with this is not like any migrant students from Sweden, let's say white skin, white blonde hair, but we mean people who are racially different. So then that's kind of what is embedded there. But then at the same time, race is often kind of avoided in the discussion. And kind of when people who are racialized try to bring these issues up and talk about what is really happening, they are often silenced. And basically, if we only focus on racism, but we don't think about what is whiteness about, then we may shift the focus away from the center of the power, because whiteness is defining kind of racialized people and racialization and racism as processes. And it's the same as we are looking at how we are going to in schools help the people who are otherized. But if we don't, what is the norm that the othering is created against? We don't really see the whole picture of the situation. So it's very important to understand that the difference is always created to something that is considered as a norm, as or a sameness, or normal, neutral. And it never exists without that. So we need to see the both sides, that the norm requires that something is defined different. So we play with the both sides at the same time. They are two sides of the same coin, so to say. So also one thing in Finland especially is, and overall, is that the discussion of racism can limit to individual life stories. So we talk about individual experiences, and they are of course very important. But if we don't then expand to the structural level, that this is not just a single story, but it's an example about something much bigger, then we don't really hit the point there. We don't get to the roots of the issue. Then, as I mentioned, like the focus may often limit to the racialized others, and then we don't look at the ideology and institutional structures that maintain racialization and whiteness. So that's why it's so important to look at how does whiteness work in the process of racialization. Here is a quote from the book Rasismi, Valta and Vastarinta, and that was mentioned at the beginning in the slide where there are those books. And I have translated this in English, and I read the English version here. To change the norm and the power structure, it is necessary to analyze the processes where whiteness is made invisible, self-evident, starting point and measure stick for those who are not considered being included in whiteness. This means, for instance, it is not enough for a researcher to name themselves being white, but the norm and the power structure must be questioned in multiple ways in researchers' work. So this means also that for the researchers, it's very important to understand how who we are influences on how we see the world, how we see our research, what kind of intentions we have, what kind of things we take as granted, etc. There are a lot of layers there as well. So here I'm going to open whiteness through four interlinked aspects. So I'm going to talk about whiteness as an identity. This is the one that typically people first can recognize, but then there are many other layers. Whiteness as an ideology, as a normative, and whiteness as an institution, and whiteness as a position of status or property. So first, when we look at whiteness as an identity, or what we often call a social category. So this is often related to whiteness as a color. So we talk about that, and color in terms of related to people's skins or other racial characteristics of being white. And here, of course, we are talking white in terms of understanding that race is a social construction and not the biological construction. The meaning given to bodies and positions those bodies are given in the power structure are also ways like how whiteness takes place. So those who can identify with and pass as white, they can be seen as white in the surrounding environment. They have privileges in that context. And as I mentioned already earlier, there are universal and contextual meanings of whiteness. So we need to think about what is somehow part of a broader structure of colonization, etc. In some ways, also capitalism, as I there a little bit later about that. And what is then somehow contextual things? What existed, what is there that comes from that context? And also the historically changing meanings of whiteness. So there are always gradients of whiteness and blackness and everything between, etc. So it's never kind of either or white or black. It's always a kind of broader hierarchy and way where people are and groups of people are placed in. And in that way, it's always a negotiation about position, exclusion from an inclusion into whiteness, meaning that different groups can also negotiate and struggle for their position in the hierarchy against each other. And often it happens, of course, that you struggle with the people or groups of people who are close to you. If you want to kind of increase your position in the hierarchy, you might play down people who you think are a little bit more black or a little bit more brown, etc., something like that, or find differentiations there in order to place yourself higher in the hierarchy of whiteness. So there is always this negotiation. And it's also when we come to racialization overall, and we know the history of eugenics and race theory, not the critical race theory, but race theory of people as if they were from different races, which is not true. So of course there was a lot of negotiation between different countries. So more than 100 years ago, or I would say like around 1900, Finland and Finns were not considered as white at all. They were considered more like people of color. They were considered people, certain groups coming from East and not white. And then Finns managed to negotiate their place and to be seen as white. So again, historically, the position has been changing there. And now when I was talking about Finns, I was referring to white Finnish people. And we know, of course, that if we talk about people of color, or we talk about different ethnic groups that have been living in Finland for hundreds of years, of course, they have then had to negotiate their place in the social structure and hierarchy against the normativity of Finnishness, whatever it's considered to be at that point. So whiteness is a changing and floating and evasive concept, yet very active and living, both for those who are not included in the category it creates and those that pursue political mobilization with it as a guiding principle. Whiteness is contextual and historically shifting, and that Nordic whiteness have a special whiteness has a special position in the discussion and in the images and fantasies of whiteness and races. This is what is related to the Nordic context. So then a little bit talk about these positions. Then I think you probably have seen one of these wheels of power and privilege before, but I again take it here in order to see like how kind of the positions are negotiated there. So there are different and intersecting positions there. So we know that there is this racialization, whiteness, but then of course there are many other things as well. And I'm going to open up a little bit more about these different wheels a little later. So then if you look at the whiteness as an ideology and normative, so that's so-called default setting in modern societies, in the knowledge, worldview, and institutions. So Laila Saad, for example, has said that white supremacy is far from fringe. In white-centered societies and communities, it is the dominant paradigm that forms the foundation of which norms, rules, and laws are created. White supremacy is an ideology, a paradigm, an institutional system, and a worldview that you have been born into if you are white by virtue of your white privilege. I'm not talking about the physical color of your skin being inherently bad or something to feel shamed about. I'm talking about the historic and modern legislation, social conditioning, and systemic institutionalizing of the construction of whiteness and inherently superior to people of other races. And basically, it also then Angelina Castaneda talks about the ideology of whiteness that also serves as a form of social amnesia that allows white people to forget or ignore how we are implicated in the maintenance of systems of privilege and oppression. And of course, when I mention here white, of course, it's also important to point out, like what Laila Saad talks about, that everyone is positioned somehow in this hierarchies somewhere. And that might be changing also contextually and situationally and in different times. And that means that it means that she's mentioned also that people of color can have certain situations where they have more privilege related to whiteness than some other. So it's also kind of something that's instead of having considering whiteness as something you have in your body, it's something you can benefit from whiteness and white privilege and white structures. So whoever can benefit, how much, how less depends on the situation and context. But the more you can benefit from that, the more effects it has in material terms and otherwise benefits for you. So then if you think about the connection between whiteness, colonialism, and capitalism, so this is of course related to that. So modernity and coloniality are also the two sides of the same coin. And then capitalism has developed in competition between the imperial nation states of the Europe. And here, identity, body, and behavior became commodities of chain exchange. So it means that Bolivar Echeverria is writing about this idea, like about the modernity and whiteness, like how whiteness becomes also the way you kind of ideal person, the idea, how the per ideal person look like, how the ideal person behaves, dresses, what kind of imaginaries they have, etc. So it's a wider structure, like how we change ourselves in order to try to fit in the norm. And there, kind of like colonialism is a longer process that started much earlier, but capitalism became part of that as well. So it's kind of strengthening these dynamics as well. There is an interesting video, like cartoon video, about this process where it shows like how people try to kind of behave and change themselves, see futures, imagine futures for them, aspirations that are from the white middle class people's ideas, and kind of leaving behind something else, and how that is part of the whiteness as a process as well. So then it's also important to kind of keep in mind that capitalism and modernity are not the exactly same thing, as I said. So there are like there are different processes, but they are interrelated processes and influence to each other. Then some certain forms of whiteness are also related to ostensible universality, neutrality, and objectivity. And these are parts of white ideology. And they also come and go back to the colonial structures and enlightenment, etc., because they're also the definitions were created about the modern world and modern person, human or man, as it was said then, and then also the racialized, colonized people who were not considered equals. So Ramon Crosswhite, for example, writes that we always speak from particular location within power structures. Nobody escapes the class, sexual, gender, spiritual, linguistic, geographical, and racial hierarchies of the modern colonial capitalist patriarchal world system. This is not only a question about social values in knowledge production or the fact that our knowledge is always partial. The main point here is the locus of enunciation. In Western philosophy and sciences, the subject that speaks is always hidden, concealed, erased from the analysis. And he also takes up this idea of the myth about the truthful universal knowledge, because he kind of highlights like how this person who speaks really is located all in all those terms somewhere in the social structure, but is often representing the world as if this position was a non-position. So kind of aiming for the neutrality in that sense, and objectivity and universality, as if everything we say would equally apply to every location, every situation, every person in the world. Kind of creating theory like that is problematic if it doesn't recognize that it's coming from the certain position in the world. And often the other positions people are kind of write out, okay, I'm coming from somewhere else. I don't come from the center of power. But people who come from the center of power are writing as if they didn't have that position. And that's what is the kind of the issue here, that is important to acknowledge where we are coming from. There is also another layer here that is related to this. Like this Cartesian person, kind of the enlightenment person, meaning this, I think, therefore I am. And that's kind of the foundation of the modern Western sciences. So, here basically, the idea is that there is often the dualism between mind and body, and between mind and nature, or humans and nature, which kind of creates again the illusion that we would have non-situated, universal, and omniscient minds. Gaston Gomez also talk about the point zero perspective in European philosophy. So the point zero is something like as if you didn't have location, and as if you could represent something from the God eye view and kind of tell about things as if it wasn't you as a human being showing and telling these things, but something higher, higher person or something like that. Then also Crossfocal is also talking about this, how this global designs their kind of height location of the subject and how the colonial domination is related to this. So we talk about this like differentiation from the 16th century, people without writing, 18th and 19th century, people without history, and then people without development and people without democracy. So these have all the time been the opposites that the Western world has been creating, like who are the others who are not us. And then rights, also from the discussion from the rights of people, the right of man, human rights, etc., always these differentiations there in terms of like what is there and how this global racial and ethnic hierarchy of Europeans and non-Europeans is there as well. Enric Dussel, again from Latin America, has reminded us, like Crossfocal writes, that this Cartesian "I think, therefore I am" person preceded 150 years the European colonial expansion. And what is kind of the interesting thing here is that first the European countries colonized the Americas, and they had all the resources from there. They had material resources, human resources, and they had also all kind of knowledge, etc., taken from those regions. And then, when they had all the wealth, they were able to define how the world is. So those who first conquer can then claim how the world is going to be. So they say that this eco conquistus, or I conquer, therefore I am, preceded this "I think, therefore I am" person. So that's sort of the first and second layers of modernity and colonization. The first layer was the material Latin America, North America colonization, and then enlightenment, and the second layer of colonization that then created the temporal continuum between so-called developed places and undeveloped places. So there are those who are advanced and those who are living in the backwardness, and that was part of their hierarchization there. So then Walter Mignolo talks about how religion became racialized. So he says that in modern space, epistemology was first Christian and then white. And then in enchanted places that were not considered as really as places of knowledge, it was non-Christian. The wisdom there was non-Christian. And then later on, that became colored. And Islam, for example, for instance, became a colored religion. So it wasn't considered anymore. It wasn't considered as something equal compared to the Christian or later on non-Christian, meaning secular knowledge. And then Christianity, particularly Protestant Christianity, became whiter after the Reformation. So it became the world way of seeing the world as being neutral. This is somehow neutral. This is equal for everyone. This is not having any kind of background. And that's very true nowadays when you talk about the world. So this kind of position that very much represents the Protestant Christianity is often taken as granted, and it's secularized Protestant Christianity even more because it doesn't need to be justified often. And then others then come against that, and it becomes something that is seen as colored religion or colored positions of view, etc. Crossfocal also talks about the importance between epistemic and social location, and saying that the epistemic location and social locations are not always the same. The fact that one is socially located in the oppressed side of the power relations does not automatically mean that he or she is epistemically thinking from a subaltern epistemic location. The success of the modern colonial world system consists precisely in making subjects that are socially located on the oppressed side of the colonial difference think epistemically like the ones in dominant positions. So it means that you may kind of agree with the logic that creates your oppressive system and support it. So it doesn't mean that you necessarily know very well the systems that are actually oppressing you there. So it's possible to be there as well. Or then, of course, it's possible to, so that your social and epistemic location are the same, that you kind of see how it goes and so on, but not necessarily. And of course, this means also considering whiteness there as well, like the social and epistemic locations may or may not be synchronized with each other. Then the third aspect is whiteness as an institution. And Angelina Castani talks about that, especially concerning schools and education system and whiteness there. And she says whiteness is a norm. It's a norm against which others are judged, and powerful is sometimes unconscious justification of the status quo. And she writes a lot about the US and the system there, like talking about being nice. Like being nice is a way to kind of bypass racism, try to be nice, as if thinking that when we are nice, racism doesn't exist, or we are nice, we say nice things to others, we don't need to do any structural changes, and that's going to fix everything. Or we are nice, we don't talk about difficult topics, meaning whiteness or racism, etc. So, or then if somebody is saying something and pointing out, hey, actually, your actions are racist, that's not nice because you are making somebody to feel uncomfortable. So how niceness actually works as a tool not to make racism as a topic to talk about, or whiteness as a topic to talk about. So Castagne also talk about whiteness and diversity policies and says that understanding the links between whiteness and diversity related educational policy and practice is an important and yet relatively unexplored task for educators. So often we write these policies, but they are very white diversity policies. And if somebody points out that we actually are not living according to those policies, or that our policies prevent us to see the real issues because we have the policies so everything should be fine, we don't have racism or any other problems, that sometimes happens. So then actually it means that the policy is preventing us to really see the real issues. So here is an example from whiteness in professions that comes from the social work and from Harriet Badwall. And she writes that the liberal foundations of the profession that are implicated in constituting colonial imperial practices of moral superiority I argue that the professional values and practices committed to the goals of social justice are the same values and practices that reinstall violence and underpin incidents of racial violence. Historically, racialized bodies have been constituted as the other, subjects to be regulated, controlled, and saved within the colonial project by white bourgeois subjects. So actually, it says that often the social justice-oriented practices, etc., and policies can actually work in order to support whiteness, to make it to stay there, because they don't really question that element, like how actually it is part of that. And the background in social work, for example, is very much that social work emerged in the US in Chicago, in the areas where these early social workers were working with the immigrants from, let's say, Poland and Southern European countries, etc., of course, from Asia later on as well. And the idea was to save the people from their otherness, kind of. They were the white saviors there. And there is a lot of to do with this equality work, but at the same time, their norms and ideals was that these kids and families would become as the white middle-class families. So there was a lot of this related there. And also, like the US African-Americans were not always considered as part of part of this, or were kind of ignored from a lot of the work that happened there, like settlement houses, etc. So there are like a lot of layers there to be explored, that how our ideas of white idea of saving the children or saving the world, saving whatever it often is, actually have this idea of whiteness there. So that there is a good intention, but it's built on reasoning that really actually creates our position and our world as more like worthy compared to the others. Then if you look at the whiteness as an institutional ideology and normativity in more detail, so Withers has been writing about that whiteness generally refers to a state or condition of white racial domination, where white values, ideas, aesthetics, preferences, and privileges are made to appear as the normalized, taken for granted basics in which to navigate the social work. This social world, this state of condition depends on the subordination of the non-whites through the very ideologies, practices, and institutions that come to define it. And then Angelina Castillo again talks about whiteness as it refers to structural arrangement and ideologies of race dominance. Racial power and inequalities are at the core of whiteness, but all forms of power and inequity create and perpetuate whiteness. White people most often benefit from whiteness. Some people of color have tapped into the ideological components of whiteness for their own financial and educational benefits. Whiteness maintains power and privilege by perpetuating and legitimating the status quo, while simultaneously maintaining a veneer of neutrality, equality, and compassion. So then if you talk about whiteness as a behavior that means fitting in the ideology and institutional norm. So there is, for example, discussion about white Protestant identity, which is a certain mode of existence, an appearance and composed to the point that it can even dispense with the racial features of whiteness, as long as the individuals show their willingness to adapt to and internalize the capitalist way of life, that is to become white. And this is especially related to previous discussion of Bolivar Echeverria, where he was looking at like how capitalism and whiteness became together, and how this Protestantism, especially Calvinist Protestantism in the US, was related to that, and creating a certain kind of work ethic, a certain kind of way of existing, and how these together are kind of creating a way of being and existing that can be discussed as white. And Echeverria also talks about blanquitude in Spanish as an ethical and civilizational character that sort of shows that you are kind of behaving like white. If you think about Bourdieu's concept of habitus and middle-class habitus, we can understand that there is some way of existing and being that kind of shows what your class position is, or you learn to swim into another kind of class position. So you kind of perform that. And here, if you think about this blanquitude, it's a little bit kind of the similar kind of idea that you learn to behave, dream about the world, as you have aspirations of white person, and you are, that's what you are targeted toward. Virginia also talk about cultural scripts of whiteness, concerning how people in different professions, let's say teachers or social workers, or teachers or social work students, learn about to act as professionals, how we are scripted, and what are the ways the professionals act in terms of show that they are professionals, and how they also show not just our class background, but also kind of the racial background. And kind of how do we learn to be? How do we learn to be as teachers? How do teachers behave? How do they stress? What kind of things they say or they don't say? How they encourage the students? How they respond to critics, etc. All these are ways we learn, and they are not just individual or professional ways. They are also very much related to the social class, gender-based, kind of masculine, feminine ways, etc., but also whiteness. So there are kind of these aspects in our professional behavior. There is also this idea about whiteness, which is kind of something you need to perform. There is an article by Deborah Fiodel, where she writes, "Why Black Students Fail." And there she describes the situation in UK schools and say that there are, because the school is white middle-class school context, so the African-American boys at the school are in conflict with their kind of cultural background and the social norms, with the norms of the school. And she says that if the boys want to be good in school, they need to behave like white middle-class students. But then they are looked down in their own peer group, where existing ways of behaving are very different. They are more like different body language, different kind of things. And then if you dare to do that, then they are kind of missed by their peer group. And then on the other hand, if they are kind of like their peer group and that's the way they behave, the school considers them as a threat, because they are behaving, talking and doing things in a way that school thinks that they are bad students or bad guys, and that becomes a problem for their performance in school. So there is a conflict between these things. And Deborah Yodel says that actually why they fail is to think that it's not about their skills or anything. It's a class of two different cultures where this boys' African-American culture and popular culture, its base of being there, is a threat for the school, and then the school doesn't think them as good students. And also, Ina Juba writes about social skills as white middle class normativity. So she says, like, social skills is a concept that is not kind of something that was born in a vacuum, but very much related to existing discussions, supermarket, et cetera, but also like how white middle class people kind of think about how a person should be and how what kind of skills the person should have. She said, like, what is actually wanted from a person in school to be normal is certain kinds of social skills. And if you don't have those skills, the right skills and right behavior for the context, it can actually justify bullying in teachers' eyes, interestingly. Because if bullying was related to some other characters that you can identify, like Miss 80, to some extent also racism was recognized always, not what kind of this idea. So there what actually happened was that when it was considered that that's your own fault, you are behaving weird, or you don't have the social skills, so you should change yourself, and then others would take you in their group. So it actually teachers were justifying the kind of bullying in that way, because they thought it's the student's own fault. So then if you think about whiteness as a position of status, that's also something then we can think about what is the outcome of all these different layers. So it's the way how identity and perception of identity can grant or deny resources. For example, self-worth, visibility, positive expectations, psychological freedom from the tether of race, freedom of movement, the sense of belonging, and the sense of entitlement to all the above, like Robin DiAngelo says. So it's also property that you can be cashed in on a daily basis, meaning that you can always take that in use and benefit from that. And also, Lila Sartre writes that white supremacy is a cistern we have born into if we are white. Whether or not you have known it, it's a system that has granted you unearned privileges, protection, and power. It is also a system that has been designed to keep you asleep and unaware of what having that privilege, protection, and power has meant for people who do not look like you. So then, to call it back for this Ina Juba's idea, when she was talking about this bullying, I'll show you a little bit of this different ways of understanding inequalities that comes also back to this whiteness and racism. So here are also a couple of social categories that we often use in order to talk about inequalities. And these are that are easier to define for us. But then there are a lot of categories of subjectivities. I call them in that way. There is no term that would be kind of shared in a way, like how to talk about that. But we have a lot of like ideas how we think a person should be. And there are these hierarchies that if you think a person, let's say, is autonomous or unautonomous or something between, if person is mattered or more towards immattered, etc. Or certain places and certain groups, we can of course think it's more than people. Here, so there are also these kind of hierarchies exist. And actually, these, while you often think that those could be individual characters or characters that are not related to any social categories, they actually are. And that's how in two ways. First, we make interpretations of people based on social categories. How we see them, how we place them in our minds, the social categories, we make interpretations how they are in the categories of subjectivities. If you think they are smart, if you think they are professional, if you think that they are mature, if you think they are trustworthy, if you think, and so on. And then at the same time, these categories very much are representations of behavior from certain social categories. As I mentioned, that there's behavior that can be considered masculine, feminine, middle class, working class, white, non-white, etc. So all of these kind of often carry kind of notions from certain kind of background in terms of social categories. So what is considered as ideal behavior, ideal way of being, thinking, is not neutral, but it's also socially constructed, and it's related to this. So basically, then if we go back a little bit to look at this, the student as a school context. So being a normal student often in school is considered being a white, middle-class, secular Lutheran student. And when I was talking about the secular Lutheran, I was exploring both the national curriculum documents, in other words, policy documents, and then school everyday life in Helsinki region. And of course, we could say that if I was observing everyday school life in Ostrobothnia somewhere, or in Kainuu, or somewhere else in a small place, maybe it could be slightly different in that context. Still, the national policies would be the same, but of course, in some certain context, there might be also differences in terms of that. But overall, I was kind of expecting this student like that. And that's also what Ina is talking about, and this normal behavior as having certain kind of social skills. So now the question is that how would the inequalities look like if we expanded our understanding of power and privilege to cover also the modes of behavior, not just social categories, but also understand that they carry certain kind of modes of behavior in them. And they also kind of originate from white ideology and normativities, as well as some others as well, and construct racialized and white or non-white student subjects or something in between. So here we go a little bit back to these wheels of power that I introduced to you earlier. And the thing that I wanted to say is that they are, of course, more like pedagogical tools. They are never like truths or the final word of them about how the world looks like. We are not trying to say that there is universal, timeless model of something that never changes. Of course, we have to always think about the context something is related to. And for example, the wheel of power for teachers is a tool to identify where am I? What is my context? How I'm placed and positioned there? And how my students are positioned as well? So, and then what should I do? It's not trying to say that school in countryside in Finland, school in city in China, or school in small town in the US would be exactly the same, because they are not, and so on. So basically here, the left side, the model you already saw earlier, this is from Sylvia Duckworth, and this is like generalization from the US context, seeing where the power is center of power is and where, how the margins are, and then thinking about how you position yourself there. On the right side is again a different model. This is also a US-based, but this is academic wheel of privilege. So instead of trying to describe the society, this is trying to describe how it looks like in the academic world and how different positions there can be created and what happens then. So it's a little bit different context than you can think about. There are more like, also like different items like funding and resources or career stage, etc., that may not be exactly the same in the whole society. And then here in Finnish, there are two models. The left side is made by Mikaela Moua, and that's based on the Julia Duckworth and another model from Canada, as you can see the source there at Lahde. And then on the right side is a model that I have created with my colleague and in Finnish, and it's sort of adapted from this previous Finnish model. And what we added there were two things. First, the regional difference. It's very different to be growing in the capital region or in big towns, in the wealthy countryside or in the poor countryside areas where more people are moving out and schools are closed, etc. That's a big difference in Finland. Another one is religion. The first one, the model on the left side, doesn't talk anything about religion and how it's sort of dividing people in terms of power and marginalization. So we added that as well, and so on. So always we need to think about what is the model. And then again, if we went to different place, let's say we went to Rovaniemi in the Lapland or Utsjoki even towards the north, if we went to Outokumpu in the eastern Finland where I'm from, or Osnabrück, let's say Pietarsaari, again, it would be a very different reality than it would be in Helsinki. So the point here is that always for teacher, it's important to think about what is the context, what are the norms there, and where am I and where are my students, and then try to find a way, how do I become aware of the things that are happening there, how the power works there, how could I create a situation where not, the students who are always put in the margin, didn't be put in the margin, what are the ways of making visible and changing the norms so that they could see that. So then I saw you two examples about the connection between social categories and behavior, how they work. So here is one example from my field notes from the school. It's a recess time, I'm in teacher's room, and there is a young Somali-born Muslim girl who entered in the teacher's room. And she has wet clothes, she's been playing outside, and her teacher goes to the other room and tries to find some dry clothes for her to change. And at the same time, two other staff members who are in the room there start talking with the girl. And they ask the girl, can you use the trousers? And she says no. And then the staff members watch each other with a glance in a certain way for a moment. And then they ask how many hours school has left for today, and it's approximately 2 hours, and then they decide we will survive then as you are, no need to change. So here, the important point here is this glance. And as being in the school doing my ethnography and spending many, many days with teachers and students, I knew that the school had certain kind of discourse about Islamic countries and Muslim students that was somehow thinking about them as being oppressed or victimized by their religion or culture. And now, of course, culture was generalization about all different countries, but that was the discourse there. So basically, we could think that there are at least two options how we could read this glance there. We could think that the staff members were wondering, okay, what are we going to do now then if she doesn't want to take the trousers? Or then the question could be, oh, you poor girl, you are a victim of your culture and of your religion. And based on what I know from the school, I believe it's the second interpretation that's closer here what happened. And sometimes if we have situations like that, we know that something is happening there. And we want to like find out what is happening, which is happening the same way in other places, other contexts with other people. Something like Ayatollah Spivak has also said is that you can try to change the context or try to change the people. So I started to think about, how about if we had a white Finnish Lutheran boy in a school and he had wet jeans, and then the school only would have skirts to change, no trousers of any kind. Would they have offered to this boy a skirt? That would you take this skirt because your trousers, your jeans are wet, so change something dry on you? Or would it happen? Would it be a realistic image? And if then the boy said, no, I don't want to have that skirt, would we think about the boy as, oh, you are a victim of your culture, Finnish culture and your Lutheran religion? Most likely we wouldn't think that way, but we think in the other way, that the girl would be the victim, and maybe her no was not her own decision, but the decision that comes from her religion or culture. We wouldn't think the decision of the boy saying no would be anything else but his own, completely own decision, independent decision. So basically there we can see that there is a differentiation. And what here actually happens is that these jeans or these trousers that are available are very like symbolically important thing there. They kind of are a symbol of equality. Like if the man or girl puts the trousers on, she shows that she's equal. But we don't believe or we don't think that the boys and men should be put the skirts on, so then they would be equal. So it's one-way process only. And here we can see that actually there is this idea of liberal equality, that women and girls are equal when they become like men and boys, and then they are free. Which is, of course, then we know that there are different interpretations of equality after that interpretation. But this is kind of the idea behind, and that's how it's interpreted, that who can perform best like this male person would be kind of more equal, and this girl's actions are interpreted against that, as she's considered as the other who cannot make the decision herself because she's considered as the other who doesn't have this freedom to decide, or it's kind of considered problematic. So we can see like how these situations, we make very different interpretations about things, and things would go very differently depending who is there in these roles, if you think about this as role play. Then there is another example. So here is like the question where I'm asking a staff member and teacher in school that are there moments or situations that have caused you to think about life differently. So my topic was about otherness in school and differentiations, etc. So here this Sarah says that, well, I think that changing my religion and what it means is surprising. When you become part of a minority, a Muslim in Finland, you find out that while legally you can practice any religion according to the law, in practice Finnish culture is not very tolerant. And then I ask, in what kind of situations do you see this? And she says, what I said before, indirect discrimination. There is not so much direct discrimination. Sometimes, of course, when somebody talks to me like I was inferior to them there is an assumption that you cannot be reasonable or grown up, no matter how old you are. If you are a Muslim, you feel you are like someone to be watched after. I think they would never talk to me this way if I did not wear a veil, because they would not see that I'm a Muslim without the veil. And then I asked, is there any difference between the two, being an immigrant and a native Finnish Muslim? Yes, there are prejudices really toward, especially towards Sunni people, because of their ethnic background. But on the other hand, when they come from elsewhere, it's more easily accepted that you are a Muslim compared to if a Finn is a Muslim. Okay, there are also situations that being a Muslim is an advantage. But people will listen to you much better for certain issues, what I say about religion as a Finnish Muslim. For example, let's take a simple example that circumcision does not belong to Islam. And sometimes you can build bridges, but occasionally it is the most terrible thing that there can be, not from my perspective, but meaning how the people around me are thinking about me. So in such situations, you do feel different. And here the interesting thing is like how the otherness here is created. So she who has been the Finnish or is Finnish, a white Finnish speaking person who wasn't Muslim before, was a Christian, and then she became a Muslim. And how her position, her decision is considered as something not being rational or not being wise, or she's otherness, there must be something wrong. This is what she talks about. And then she talks that for others, it is more accepted to be a Muslim because they are from elsewhere. So people are already otherized. They are already other, and that's because their decisions or that they are born being Muslims is not questioned in the same way. It's accepted. And that's like how she, her decision is seen different because she's considered leaving behind something that the people would value as a good place to be or a good way to believe, etc. And then see, on the other hand, she says that how the position changes sometimes. So when she tries to speak on the behalf of a community or behalf of some kind of you, people may then listen to her more. So they somehow think that she is a more trustworthy voice to believe concerning when she talks about these issues. So you can see how this position is shifting. In some situations, she is not seen that other. In other situations, she's seen as somebody who is closer to the norm and can be considered as somebody who can be kind of voicing these things and bringing things up, as she's better heard there. So then when you think about whiteness, also one important aspect is the white resistance to talking about race and whiteness. And this is something like often when you talk about topics, they don't always talk about emotions and resistance. But here it's very critical and crucial. And I will come to that very soon, why this is critical here. So basically, here the situation is that the discourses of diversity, multicultural equality, as statements, they kind of are silent about the racial equalities. They're often silent about many inequalities, but especially racial inequalities. And we have often this background that we celebrate diversity and multiculturalism. We really talk about the racial issues there. And then also considering about the school space, and we made an interesting study with the colleagues from different school spaces in Finland and in the US. And we looked at like, how they talk about the diversity overall, and we then narrowed down to ethnic, cultural, language-based diversity, and social class. And then like basically like how they, what is the center of power there, and how they talk about power inequalities. So there were different kind of schools in both countries. Some of the schools were diversity and power mute. So it means that they really didn't talk about diversities. They were very much represented the normative, not the differences, and they never talk about power issues either. Then there were schools that celebrated diversity. They had a lot of things like, we have so many languages in class, we have so many something cultural backgrounds, but they never talk about the clashes or power inequalities that could take place as well. And then some schools were those that really talk about both the diversity, but also about the power hierarchies. For example, they made visible like how the global or local like structure of work and poverty was created, and what kind of different groups there were in terms of those who own, who manage, and who live in poverty. That was in a school that was in a very poor area in the US. So kind of talking with students about how this works in the society. Those schools were very few. There was it wasn't kind of by any means mainstream. So the power and diversity in schools, or those who talk about diversity as a positive thing, but they don't talk about the power inequalities, they're very, very much the same. Then if we talk about the university context, there is also like interesting question about the university student applicants and how equality is interpreted in that case. So often this kind of similar treatment is considered as equality, and that's a good thing. No changes whatsoever, everything for same for everyone. And that was also one of those examples. Then here, one thing that is related to racism is the kind of individualization of racism, and kind of not to see it as a historical and societal issue. So often bullying, discrimination, and racism and exclusion are considered to be problems of individual people, not signals about normative thinking patterns, rules, or practices that are systematically excluding and discriminating people who don't fit in the norms. That often challenges when we consider racism as something that is related to individuals, as not as a system. And then also like the problem is considered in single students or teachers. There is a student who is racist, or there is a teacher who is racist, and not as something that is part of the educational institution and part of our knowledge, part of our society, part of our global world order, etc. And then also like being bullied and excluded can be considered as student's own fault when the student behaves in the wrong way, as I said earlier about this in a Yuva study. So here's also an example about from Shelley and Tate that how these kind of trainings, especially in the university context, but also beyond in organizations, trainings that are called unconscious bias trainings, can be actually ways out to, how they kind of work in this context. Are they ways out of racial inequality, or are they actually part of it? And they write about this thing that actually often these trainings recenter white supremacy by removing the blame and accompanying shame and guilt, which is part of the process of unlearning white supremacy. White fragility emerges as vulnerability, anger, fear, for it's the only balm is the self-forgiveness, because you simply didn't actually even know. Your racism was unconscious. After all, unconscious bias begin from the premise of inevitability and normalization. However, self-forgiveness is inactive as an approach to institutional racism because it relies on introspection and on the part of the white self and institution, which is what Yancey calls a distancing strategy. Unconscious bias is a strategy to distance the white self from the charge of racism. And indeed, that one extent of white supremacy and its impact on black people and people of color and on white people themselves by focusing on the white suffering that results from irrational claims of anti-black and people of color racism. Unconsciousness bias maintains white supremacy and indeed, its very definition insists that racist culture and environment are crucial to its existence. So actually that this unconscious bias training, although they try to kind of remove racism and try to make change there, they focus more like healing the feelings of white people and kind of instead of really changing the structure, they don't really change what is there. And that's sort of the critique that has been there, that there should be more talk about why the dealing with the emotions and doing the structural change are more both important. Then one form of this whiteness is also the how we talk about, how we use the terms. So when we use abstract terms, that are so-called terms that are decontextualized. Decontextualization is a certain kind of development of societies in Finland since 1970s, elsewhere a bit earlier, where instead of talking about context in more detail, you talk about generalizations. You have schools, you have regions, you have students, etc., you have societies, but you don't really define who they are, what kind of students they are, etc. And then actually what happens is that it looks like inclusive, everyone is included, but at the same time, it's very normative and exclusive, because we always imagine a certain kind of student or teacher in the picture when we say student or teacher. And if we don't unpack our beliefs, it might be that we are, let's say, planning on teaching to a very narrow group of students, because we imagine, let's say, by the middle class students, and then they are not, and then we realize that our teaching really doesn't reach everyone, or there are learning challenges, other disabilities, etc. So this means that often these terms are kind of easy, because you really don't need to define, but that's also the trap that you may not really pay attention to, that what connotations, what ideas are embedded in this idea of student or teacher, etc. So it's important to look, okay, if somebody says students, or you say students, what do you mean really by that? Which students, from where, how they are, and so on. And then also like these ideas about every student, when it's used as every, so often these all children or every children are used as racially coded language, like in the US, this No Child Left Behind Act, that used the terms every child, all children should have this and that. It doesn't really mean every child, it meant those who were different, those who were racially different, they should be included in this and that. So again, it's the way to talk about using this coded language. We often assume that there is a neutral ground and equal space of dialogue when we talk about racial or other inequalities. So let's say there are the sayings that, okay, if there are people who are coming to the situation, they have two different views and two different experiences and two different sets of knowledge behind, and then they negotiate what is going to happen. So there are the sayings that we both have to be flexible and meet in the halfway. Often in this kind of sayings, the assumption behind is that they both are doing the same kind of travel. But in, of course, if you think about the power hierarchy, we know that the person who is not in a privileged position has had to do a lot of compromises and work much longer in order to get to the point they are at the moment than the person who comes from the more privileged background. So the halfway is just a very imaginary thing. It doesn't really exist. It as if the travel and the journey would be the same, but that's not true. So often in this situation, it's considered as if there was a vacuum where these people are not part of their social context. They are in the vacuum and both of them take equally the same number of steps. But that doesn't really in reality happen. So it's always a very different thing. And that's often the challenge when let's say migrants in Finland or students, whoever is required to do something, not to pay attention to what have they done so far, what has happened so far, how many steps do they need to take, have they had to take already in order to get there where they are now. Also assuming that the negotiations take place between equals. So negotiating about things in this kind of Habermasian biological space as if we were equal. So even there it's admitted that we are not really equal, but let's imagine we are equal and now we negotiate. That's the background of this. But that's not true. We are never equal. Someone's terminology is used, someone's language, someone's way of arguing is used. For someone, the language we use, no matter if it's Finnish, English or academic language or professional language, is more familiar than for someone else. It's always kind of very much related to those norms that are in the space and also like what is the social background of these people who are in the space. Then another way how their neutral ground is there is to require the same space for everyone. Everyone must be together. We don't want a different space for racialized students, white students, or in academic conference like Sara Ahmed talks, we shouldn't have space for racialized academics and white academics in certain kind of situation. And again, as thinking of space would be the same for everyone. But we know that space in most cases is white space, and people of color are not feeling like they are in their home because it's mostly dominated white space. And that means that if somebody is requesting space for people of color, then it would be a different space where you can talk about different things because everyone shares some kind of understanding about what does it mean to live in the racialized world. So again, assuming that everyone should be together and not in the same space is also kind of not to understand like how these power dynamics works. And then also Alison Jobes from the New Zealand talks about this example of passion of ignorance. She talks about that situation that they had the teacher education there. They had the white New Zealanders and then also the indigenous New Zealanders there in the same program. And at some point, the indigenous people wanted to have their own groups. They said that they want to have the space of their own in order to discuss what is going on and how they have been feeling racism and exclusion in the society. And then the white people felt very offended because they said, oh, we want to learn from these indigenous people. And now they are in their own group. We don't learn anything. And they were thinking about that they have the right to learn from the other, to hear their experiences and their pain and everything, and learn from that. While for these indigenous people said, well, we know the system. We know the white system. We know who we are as indigenous people. We want our space to talk about our own emotions and our burden and everything. And it's not kind of that we are a kind of information source for the white people to create understanding. It's their point to themselves figure out what this is about. And that was an interesting thing that was going on, like how this separation of spaces was reacted so strongly by the white students there. And then later on, they did something like they took also the lecturer, who was a Maori speaker, to speak in Maori language, the lectures. And again, the white students were saying, like, no, we don't understand anything about this. This is a waste of time. We don't want to be there. And until then, everyone was in English, and Maori students always were studying in English. That was not their language, first language. And they didn't think that, okay, this makes it visible how it is to be as a foreign language student or shift the power thing. But they just think that this was like nonsense. And then again, this was the kind of discussion what was happening there, and a lot of interesting analysis about that situation. Then a couple of examples also about how the discussions of race are often silenced. Andrea Kastner talks about from the US example, teachers say you cannot ask anyone's race or nationality. It's not allowed here. In other words, in school, you're not allowed to talk about racism, race, or anything like that. No question, no discussion. And then from Finland, from my own field notes, there is a case that was related to sixth graders in primary school who were about to make choices where they will start their seventh grade. So it was three time damage selection process. And then one student, this is now in Finnish, but I translated in English, that was sort of a person of color, say that in the one school, the rector of the school said that all the students who are black or so that kind of will be sent to another school. And then another student who was also like dark skinned said, no, that's terrible. And she was very like offended and shocked. The teacher was very confused and intervened, like, no, that cannot be true. It can't be like that. And she didn't know really what to say for this kind of statement. And then the discussion was going on. And then it came out that that was sort of exaggeration from the student number one. So the rector didn't literally say that, well, we don't take any black students, they will be sent to other school. That didn't happen. But even teachers in the same school thought that for interesting reason, every time from our school, somebody whose last name is Muhammad or Ahmed or something else who is applying for the school to that school never get in. They are never to be taken as students there, basically, or almost never. So they knew that somehow the selection system left these kind of students out. And of course, the families knew it as well because they have the experience, they have knowledge how it works. And the students know what the parents are talking about. So they're aware of the phenomenon. And the teacher didn't really know like what to say in this situation. And when the students started to talk about this thing in their own languages, other than Finnish, and like talk about what's happening. So the teacher says, don't use other languages because it's not polite to be in the same room and use other languages. So she wanted to silence the discussion about the racism again. And it was making this argument that you only need to speak Finnish that everyone can understand. So here, like, the teacher really didn't take out the thing, like, what is behind of this? That even if it was literally not true what the student said about the rector, the phenomenon was there, and that's what the students wanted to talk about, that there is a racial hierarchy here in work. So that's a question. So then when you talk about the emotions related to whiteness and reactions, so there is basically a situation often that white people and institutions feel it difficult to talk about race, racism, and whiteness. And that discussion often involves a lot of emotions. That has been conceptualized in terms of white fragility by Robin DiAngelo, and then there is a lot of that also in Laila Saad's book, Me and White Supremacy. And basically, Laila Saad is writing about this idea that white fragility is a state in which even a minimum amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering a range of defensive moves. These moves include outward display of emotions such as anger, fear, and guilt, and behaviors such as argumentation, silence, and leaving the stress-inducing situation. These behaviors, in turn, function to reinstate white racial equilibrium. So here are a couple of examples about the white fragility, like reasons why that happens. So one is the lack of exposure to conversations about racism. And this is something that Laila Saad talks about, that when she was a small kid, her mother said, look, she had to sit down and said, look, because you are Muslim, you are a girl, and you are a person of color, you have to work three times harder than someone else in order to succeed. And since then, there was an understanding with her that there is a racial structure, and gender structure, and racial structure there she has to work with in order to survive. And there was a discussion of race. But Laila Saad says that often the white people haven't learned to talk about racism. They have lack of language to talk about racism in everyday situations, how to talk about it, or what it could be about. Then another reason is this lack of understanding about what white supremacy is about. So more focusing on individuals, that it's an individual thing, instead of seeing that it's a historical, contextual, and systemic approach. Then also like racial status quo is very comfortable for white people all the time. But of course, then when it's challenged, they are out from their comfort zone. So status quo is changed, and then they feel uncomfortable in this situation. So it's shifting like the normal situation to them to something very abnormal. And then, of course, there are a lot of terms how we avoid using the term race and racism. So how not to name the elephant in the room. Let's say in Europe, there's a lot of discussion about people in terms of ethnicity or culture, but actually talking about race and racism. And there's an interesting article linked here. What do you call people who aren't white? Like people are not trying to use different expressions in order not to talk about the race and whiteness there. Then also, like, there is a way with white people to deny racism in ways that they think that are very innovative and personal, but they are actually very typical. A lot of people do the same. And there are different kind of racism or whiteness bingos, and this is one of them that I have taken. And here are a couple of arguments people use that when somebody is kind of saying, when it's kind of, hey, actually, in your thinking or what you said, there was a racist pattern or there was something like that. So how people react to these situations. And a lot of colleagues who are people of color say that they could play this bingo in many places and also at the university. Like, they always hear the same arguments from white people again and again and again, and racism is taken up. Like, how people respond to that, their personal reactions, then there are sort of kind of more collective reactions, etc. But it happens again. They hear the same arguments over and over again. So basically, these are collective social constructions, how we have learned as white people to respond to these claims that there was some kind of unconscious racism or racism we didn't understand there exists in the situation. Then Laila Saar talks a lot about that, how racial discomfort is inherent to authentic examination of white privilege. So without that discomfort, the racial status quo is protected, and if you are in this comfort space, we really don't learn much anything. So she says that challenging emotions like shame, anger, grief, rage, apathy, anxiety, and confusion will come up for you if you are doing this work or unpacking whiteness deeply. Don't run away from the feelings. Feelings which are an appropriate human response to racism and oppression is an important part of the process. When you allow you to feel those feelings, you wake up, you rehumanize yourself. You start to realize that you have shut down part of your humanity in order to participate in white supremacy. White supremacy purposely numbs you to the pain that your racism causes. Doing thus work brings back the real feelings of pain, of what committing racism actually feels like physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. And she says that the idea is not to end up living in shame, but kind of, or in guilt, but to see what it is about and start acting on to change of the situation. And in that picture, that is something like that has been used to illustrate what is it about becoming anti-racist, and also like how there are these different layers. So there is this zone of fear, which is like when we don't want to go from our comfort zone one step further in order to see those situations, or then we kind of bounce back in a way that we don't want to talk about that. Then if we go further, then there is the learning zone, when we start to explore our own position in this hierarchy and in this system, and we start to learn from others. And then the growth zone is that when we also are accepting the situation that we are feeling discomfort with this situation, and we also are willing to kind of promote the new things in order to the situation. And we also don't feel that the mistakes we make, because we all make mistakes. It's a new situation to start to learn to read the world and be aware, knowing that there are structures, white structure, and as white people, we are able to benefit from it. Or if we are like also like people of color, we might have some like benefits compared to some other people who don't even have those benefits. So in that way, it's not just white and black, it's much more nuanced. But we don't think about that we should stop because we made a mistake. We are willing to take risks and learn from the situations, because those situations reveal something about the structure to us that we didn't see before. So then there are a lot of this how also like racism is denied in Finland. Here are a couple of examples that I think I have recognized myself happening in Finland, in schools and universities. And like one is that there cannot be racism in our university because we have equality policy, let's say, or not in my own actions or thinkings. Or that because we have students who are people of color, black people, so it doesn't concern us. Or that Finnish educators are knowledgeable enough not to discriminate people or students. Or we are personally supervising so many students, or we have friends who are people of color, so we cannot be racist for that reason. Racist, that's the reason, etc. Or the situation in Finland takes time, it's a new situation, or the racism in Finland has been for a long, long time. It's a new thing, as I told at the very beginning of this lecture. And then there are also like situations when a person of color tells something that has happened, there has been a racist incident, we don't want to believe that person, also it could be sexual harassment, but also a racist incident, but we want somebody else to verify that if that really happened. And the person who verifies this experience is typically a white person. So what people of color tell is not always taken seriously. Then there are different situations when the denial of the need of change is there. So saying it's too difficult or difficult to understand, difficult to change, just about wondering where everything is going to end up. Chasing traces is too difficult, or that right, we need to talk about things with their right names, meaning that we are as if we would have the right to use the terms that are very offending for some people. Different kind of discourses in society as well. Then the emotional reactions as well. There are a couple of here, like basically like how people are kind of reacting to the situation when we talk about racism and what happens then. Or then let's say if you try to do something and people are reacting back and saying that, hey, that was a really white reaction, really like white way of seeing the world, that's not the problem. Then people feel very, very offended because I just tried to help, I tried to be nice. And now they are saying that I was racist, that's terrible. And then it doesn't really show that even the good intentions we have might still be containing racism, not because we wanted or we were aware of it, but because that's the way we see the world, that's how we grew up. And then when somebody says people feel offended because they didn't want to, that was not their intention. But racism doesn't mean that there is intention. It means we learn to be the world the way we are. If you always live in a family that had a house, or an older house, and had two cars, you would easily say that, well, let's go to that place and go there by car. And someone else would say, well, I'm living in the rental car and I don't own the car. I cannot use that kind of travel logic because I don't have that access. Maybe we feel the same way. Maybe we would feel a little bit ashamed, but maybe we would feel so much ashamed that it racism, when it was revealed that we were thinking the world from a very privileged position. And that can, of course, happen many, many times in different ways. What kind of food we eat, what kind of food we have afford for, what kind of movies we watch, what kind of clothes we use, what kind of sports we do, or other hobbies, etc. They tell a lot about our position in the society. And we might think sometimes it's something we do if we are privileged, that this kind of granted, taken as granted position. And a lot of people don't have that access to the same. So it's making it simple that you're thinking, or your way of being, there was a good intention, but you didn't really see that my situation is very different from yours. And that's kind of what it all is about learning that, or unlearning what was kind of seen as normal to us, and seeing that the world is a lot more complex. So basically, a few last words about this. So basically, one thing is that if we have experienced othering, exclusion, and discrimination in one area, let's think back of those wheels of power, whatever it could be, during our life, maybe we could understand something like how it is for others and make kind of a transfer of experience, of transfer of positions, and think that if I felt that way because of what class background I come from, what religion, what region, etc., and I felt that I was discriminated or othered, could it be something similar kind that is happening for others? And of course, understanding it's not equal the same always. We cannot say like what we did is the same for others. And often we also put other things together and think about, okay, if something worked in this way for me, it would work the same way for the others. And there might be more nuances there or more factors in the picture. So we cannot assume that our way of solving issues is the same for others. But it could help us to emotionally understand and on level of experience what it is about. Then also to recognize that racism is always a structural problem and it concerns everyone. We cannot simply step out from this world that is historically has historically sedimented inequalities. And unlearning discrimination and racism quite really means that we have to learn more just and equal ways of thinking and acting. And that's a lifelong journey. It doesn't happen overnight. So then also like it's important to recognize the practices that maintain racism and white positions in identities. And that's also a long process, a lifelong process. And also instead of feeling pity about the privileges or shame, it's important to think how can you use those privileges for social change to kind of erode the privilege that there is, how we can use the power the way that we are heard better than someone else to change situations. Also, it's important to intervene and stop discriminative situations and basically and also name racism that is there, sexism, whatever it is. Because then when the problem is named, it's easier to talk about that. Also to call for change and ask for help when needed. Then one way to be an ally for those who are otherwise and discriminated. And there are a lot of there's a lot of information about that. What does it mean? Vanessa Sandra has been writing that it's always better to try new things and fail instead of not trying at all. So instead of being frozen and think I cannot do anything because I may make a mistake, it's always better to try new things because this is how we can learn. This is how we can change things. If we freeze there, we cannot change anything. And that is that this is, of course, like a thing where it's not individual journey, but we are more effective together when we do this together with others. We learn and change things together. Thank you. Now, if you have any questions, so I'm here and you can stay and ask questions. That's the end of the lectures, so I think recording time.